international finance law. We can understand all of the nature and structure of the principal international financial markets and the structure and operation of these markets and the key legal and regulatory issues that arise through these core slides which have been provided. We're looking at financial markets and financial instruments. We need to understand the structure of the main markets. We have the money markets, the banking or credit markets, and then the capital markets, which include the bond markets, equity markets, and derivative markets. We need to understand the importance and significance of financial intermediation, which is the role and function of the largest financial institutions in collecting, bringing together financial wealth, financial value in any economy, and then distributing and making that available across the rest of the economy where needs are most significant. So we basically take excess surplus assets and value within the system and we redistribute it round the system, which makes the most effective long-term use and application of financial resources at any one time. This is the key function of financial markets, intermediation. But this also creates financial risk, so we need to understand the nature of the key risks involved, and then we can look in further detail at regulation and the structure and operation of the main regulatory devices that are adopted to manage the risk that can arise so we can protect the core functions involved. And then we'll also look at private contract and remedy, specifically in connection with international finance markets. Because these markets are so large, there is no government or public entity that's large enough to control the risks in the markets, so the markets effectively regulate themselves on a self-regulatory basis. We are looking at the main markets. So we have the money markets, the primary money markets in which the central bank will deal with a small select group of preferred large commercial banks or other financial institutions. We refer to this as the UK discount market in the United Kingdom or the discount window in the United States. We then have a series of secondary money markets, which are other markets which produce debt or claims by specialist groups, which is then bought and sold on a wholesale basis. With the local authority market, the intercompany market, the sterling certificate of deposit market, the certificate of deposit market, and the interbank market. And we'll come back and look at all of these in further detail. In terms of lending and credit markets at the international level, we have the euro loan market, which is that segment of the international euro dollar market which provides lending facilities. However, because these amounts are so large, it's always done on a group or syndicate basis. We can also look at commercial banking markets, which are essentially all other lending and credit markets apart from the money markets, which are essentially wholesale, but only up to a duration of 1 year. And then we can look at investment banking separately. Investment banking itself is actually an accident of American English or American language. Investment banks were created at the beginning of the 1930s following the stock market collapse in New York in 1929. The American authorities considered that the crisis had been caused by the mixing of banking and securities markets, and so the decision was taken to separate commercial banking and securities business. This was under the Glass-Steagall provisions of the Banking Act 1933, which separated the two key sectors. That then led to the emergence of commercial banking and investment banking. Although we use the term in America, investment banking, an investment bank is not a bank. It cannot take deposits. It cannot provide lending on own account, which is the key function of banking. Investment banking is a misnomer. It's essentially a securities house. It's a securities firm. It's connected with the securities markets. And we'll come back and look at that in further detail. In terms of the capital markets, we have the debt markets or bond markets. These are the largest markets in the world. We then have the equity markets. We have warrants and hybrid markets, depository receipt markets, and euro dollar markets. We'll also come back and look in further detail at the derivatives markets, currency markets, gold bullion, and other commodity markets. All of the key terms that arise in this area are defined in the materials provided. This was actually very interesting. There's a large number of core points of language and terminology that do not have any clear, relevant legal definition at this time. So one of the key exercises that I had to follow in building all of this up was to identify all of these key terms and then define each one of them. So all this is provided for in the introductory document and then in the larger document that's made available on the system. So a market is any identifiable location, system, or set of formalized relations through which we can buy or sell any product or commodity. A financial market is any organized process through which financial contracts or claims can be issued and traded. An exchange is an identifiable location on which contracts or instruments can be issued and traded. A stock market and stock exchange is an organized or regulated marketplace for trading government or corporate stock and shares. Security is a transferable confirmation, certification, or representation of rights underlying a proprietary interest, which is a shows or a debt is a claim. Financial function. There's five key financial functions: savings or deposit, loan or credit, payment, investment, and risk management. A bank is a financial intermediary that accepts deposits and grants credit on own account. A bank does two key things. It accepts funds from the general public. It then pools, aggregates those, and then lends them on its own account. A bank has to do both. There's a number of activities and a number of more specialist markets that involve either deposit taking or lending, but if they do not do the two together, accepting repayable deposits from the general public and granting credit on own account, they do not constitute a bank. Financial intermediation is the matching or linking excess with deficit financial capacity or elements within the financial system. Financial value or benefit I've summarised on the right-hand side, and I developed that in further detail in the introductory paper provided. I also provide separate diagrams which break down the core financial risks and then the nature of the key regulatory devices adopted to manage or contain those risks. With regards to financial risks, we have financial risks, operational risks, legal risks, management risks, and then wider environmental or sort of external. I've now extended this following the coronavirus crisis to include more general exogenous as opposed to endogenous. Endogenous means inside the market, internal, and then exogenous is external, as well as existential threats which may lead to the collapse of the system and society more generally, which could include biological pandemics as well as, for example, climate factors. And I provide separate papers, documents, and materials on this. In terms of financial risks, there's five key risks. Market or position risk is the risk that a security will rise or fall on the market. Credit risk is counterparty default risk. That's the main exposure for a bank. The core exposure for a securities firm is market or position risk, number one. For a bank, it's credit or counterparty default risk. That's the risk that the borrower will not pay interest during term or repay principal on maturity. It's both of those things. We have separate currency risks or foreign exchange risks, other interest rate risks, and then financial derivatives risks. There's a series of other risks which we could incorporate into the financial category: liquidity risk, reinvestment risk, inflation risk, spread risk, performance risk, timing, commodity basis risk. I found altogether between 80 and 90 risks which could be identified in total. However, for our purposes, we want to focus on the financial risks, operational risks, key legal risks, management, and then exogenous risks. Operational risks are to do with systems and electronic digital management support. It could be internal or external fraud, personnel failure, and then information technology systems or other electronic or digital defect or failure. Those also include delivery risk, aggregation risk, technological risk, and others. Legal risk is concerned with the ability to enforce the documentation that has been entered into. We need to consider this in terms of capacity or vires. That's the ability of the other agent in a financial contract to enter into this. This has caused difficulties in practice where, for example, local authorities have entered into complex financial transactions such as swap transactions, and it was held that they did not have legal authority to do that. We must always check as part of the conditions precedent and the due diligence work that's carried out in financial transactions that all parties to the transaction have full legal capacity to enter into the transactions concerned. And for that purpose, we will check memorandum and articles of association or other constitutional documents, and we will also take specific board resolutions to confirm agreement to enter into the transaction. So capacity is an important issue. We need to consider documentation validity. We need to consider enforceability. Can we get legal judgment? And then can we enforce that judgment in particular countries? This becomes relevant, for example, in the project finance area. We need to ensure that if we are lending 100 million billions of dollars to a country in an emerging economy, that we can legally enforce the documents, all of the rights, including specifically the security concern. We can get legal judgment, and then if we get a legal order, that we can also execute that in practice against the assets concerned. All of this has to be considered in large, complex international financial transactions. We also then have to consider wider management and conduct risks. This goes back to internal personnel issues. And then, as I've mentioned, we're now going to look at other exogenous and existential risks. I've constructed an exogenous or existential risk model based on 6 points of biological or pandemic factors, natural disasters such as earthquakes and tsunami, climate impacts, essentially droughts and floods, technology failure, regulatory failure, and then military aggression of some form, which could include nuclear proliferation, as well as, more commonly now, nanorobots, lethal autonomous weapons, or LAWs, biotechnology and nanotechnology. And we can come back and look at all of this. This has become particularly relevant with regards to the climate crisis and the acceptance that a core part of the climate response will be the ability of financial markets to pool and make available the necessary finance to support new carbon neutral, carbon sustainable economies, as well as to price all of the climate related carbon risk involved. In terms of financial regulation, we can construct a basic regulatory model based on financial regulation, financial support regulation. We have financial rules, we have conduct of contract rules, we have market rules. Financial rules are basically based on controlled by entry requirements and market exit requirements. We can come back and look at that in find further detail. We can expand on financial rules, conduct rules and market rules. This simply ties this in to the key UK provisions as set out in the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000 as amended, including specifically by the Financial Services Act 2012, which established the dual regulatory regime. We initially had a single regulator, regulatory model with the Financial Services Authority. We then replaced that by having a separate Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, and Prudential Regulation Authority, PRA, with the Bank of England subsequently being appointed the PRA. We can come back and outline the key regulatory provisions which apply in practice later. The core issue that arises in terms of managing risks and protecting rights and obligations in these markets is the fact that no single government or public agency is large enough to control these markets on an authoritative and realistic basis. So these markets essentially operate on a self-driving regulatory basis. We could consider some form of public international law solution, although that would have to essentially be some form of international treaty or convention. However, that would be politically, operationally, and financially ineffective and impracticable. We therefore have to look for market, self-regulatory, and membership or private contract law solutions in substitute for a formal treaty-based response. Formal treaty would be costly to agree, expensive, and involve very substantial formality and delay. There's very significant political sensitivity in this area, which makes this very difficult to agree. Managing financial markets is almost as close to managing military and military engagement in terms of authority, sovereign autonomy. It would be very difficult to agree a formal international treaty in terms of daily, day-to-day financial market management. Countries would inevitably insist on national variation and adjustment. We would then have an inconsistent, incoherent result with potential conflicts. In any case, there's a lack of international effective oversight. There is no effective private or sovereign body large enough to conduct meaningful review or oversight. And then, even if we could, there's a lack of any effective enforcement mechanism. There's no meaningful private or sovereign sanction which we could apply. The alternative then is a wholesale or market self-regulatory solution based on professional trade association advantage. In summary, this reflects market practice, best risk management, standard documentation, industry representation, public understanding. So we're going to attempt to realise full maximum market or self-regulatory advantage. This is expert and relevant. The documentation is prepared by market professionals who design and structure all of the rights and obligations concerned. It's immediate and integral. We can incorporate this into private law contracts directly, which are enforceable under national and public international law. It's flexible and responsive. We have continuous revision in response to market changes. We have cost and ease of revision. We can change this quickly without the need for a formal treaty amendment. And all of this is based on voluntary adoption and compliance, which creates an internal market culture of self-interest and internal adoption and implementation. There are some potential limitations. For example, it is stated that there could be conflicts of interest, lack of transparency, possible anti-competitive effects, no wider public interest consideration, and no meaningful systemic control. However, we are able to deal with all of these in practice, and even following major international financial crises, all of the core financial documentation has always remained integral and secure and fully enforceable. In terms of how this operates in practice, we have a series of key international trade associations which come together and prepare documentation in each of the key sectors or markets concerned. There's a number of these. The most important, three largest and most significant, are the Loan Market Association, LMA, the International Capital Markets Association, ICMA, and the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, ISDA. The LMA was established in 1996. It has over 400 members, substantially more now. Its purpose is to maintain efficient execution of loan business, to improve liquidity, provide for the management of loan portfolios on a more efficient and effective basis, develop a collective approach and reduce costs to market operations, provide for a timely exchange of views, provision of a dedicated website, education and training support, and then meaningful engagement with participation in issues and problem solving. We can understand the basic board governance structure, which is dealt with in the materials. There's a number of committees that operate through the LMA, including the agency, distressed debt, documentation, loan operations, and trading practices and tax committees. The key contribution is the standard documentation and we will look in detail at the multi-currency term loan document produced by the LMA. The ICMA was originally set up through a merger of the International Primary Markets Association, IPMA, and International Secondary Markets Association, ISMA, in July 2005. Originally, it had been set up as the Association of International, I think it was Broker Dealers, AIBD, in the 1950s and 60s. That then changed its name to the ISMA in 1991, and it merges with the IPMA to create the ICMA. The purpose is to maintain high standards of market practice, promote advocacy on appropriate market regulation. It makes available a specific electronic trade systems and market data system, the TRACS. It supports education and research, provides networking, information and events management services. It's got, again, a formal governance structure with a number of committees, including regulatory policy, market practices, primary market practices, secondary market practices, legal documentation, euro, commercial paper. The ICMA, again, operates through standard documentation. It's a slightly different model in that the ICMA has a rule book, which was originally the IPMA rule book, which it revised following the merger with the ISMA. The rule book essentially sets out in a structured form all of the key clauses and provisions which are expected in international capital market documentation. The reason we don't have a simple set of documents is that in the capital market area, there's more parties, so therefore more documents, and we spread the provisions over a wider range of specific contracts. There is then less need to prepare particular standard documents because they're shorter and there's more of them. It's easier to do this with a separate architecture using a core rulebook, which outlines all of the key provisions which will be incorporated into this documentation. So the key handbook was the IPMA, it's now the ICMA, International Capital Market Association Handbook, and then there's also the Global Master Repurchase Documentation, 1995 and 2000, and we'll come back and look at the repo market subsequently. The International Swap Markets Association was originally a conference forum chartered in 1985, which then develops a key role in the derivatives area. I think it was originally the International Swaps Dealers Association, which became the International Swaps and Derivatives Association. It has over 800 members from 56 over 60 countries now. Key contribution are the master agreements and the annexes which it prepares. There was the 1992, and now the key document is the 2002 master agreement, which we will go over in substantial detail. The master agreements create standard terms and conditions which cannot be altered. They have annex provisions which set out a series of elective clauses or choices which you can use to amend the operation of the master agreement. Parties then make changes to the annex, not to the master agreement itself. A master agreement is entered into between each party pair in the international derivatives area. So all of the main international banks and securities firms enter into master agreements with each other, with a dedicated annex setting out the specific terms and conditions with regards to on terms of which they will trade with each other. In terms of daily contracts, those are then set out in the confirmations. So we have a master agreement in standard terms. We have optional annexes which set out the more elective, selective clauses. And then we have daily confirmations which evidence specific contracts. There'll be one master agreement. There may be thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of confirmations entered into under that master agreement. We either have a long form or a short form confirmation, depending upon whether we have, thirdly, separate standard definitions prepared by the ISDA. In core important standard markets such as the currency market, interest rate, commodity and equity. There will be a set of standard definitions which support the master agreement. If there's standard definitions, we can have short form contract confirmations. They may be as short as one page. If we don't have definitions, we then need longer 10-15 page confirmations for each contract. The ISDA also collects legal opinions across the world to confirm the operation and effectiveness of its key provisions, including specifically with regards to netting and credit or collateral support. There's two key netting clauses in the ISDA 2002 Master Agreement. One provides for continuous netting, such as on a monthly or weekly basis, as well as closeout netting, which is where the contract relationship is terminated and the parties settle out all outstanding obligations on a net basis. So we have two sets of netting clauses: the continuous transaction or payment netting, which will occur regularly under all of the confirmations and single master agreement, and then if we terminate the master agreement, we'll have a closeout provision that applies. We need to confirm that those two netting sets of provisions and the other clauses in the documentation are enforceable in all key financial jurisdictions. Therefore, ISDA collects standard opinions on an annual basis, which are updated for its members. We also have opinions governing the collateral provided. The key point is that in this market, it operates on a assigned collateral basis. The large banks and investment firms do not have to trust each other, simply because in relation to all of their transactions, they will put up a degree of collateral to support the risk in these contracts. This is how the stability and integrity of this enormous market can be protected in practice. The total market, international financial derivatives, is worth in excess of $600 trillion. How can we do that without any formal regulation? We do it through standard documentation and, in practice, collateral support. There's actually a deed or an annex attached to the master agreement. We have a deed, if we can charge, which creates security without the need to transfer title to move the security from one party to another, which occurs in some, for example, continental jurisdictions. In Anglo-American countries, you can charge assets, create security without moving or transferring title. If you need to transfer title, you would have an annex. So you'll have the master agreement, which will then have a deed or an annex attached, depending upon the nature of the collateral support to be provided. There's then a series of other documents that we can use in practice, including, for example, multi-agreement amendment provisions, which are protocols. For example, after the Greek debt crisis, there was a standard set of amendments made to ISDA master agreements. All that simply happens is ISDA produces a protocol and the parties adopt that protocol. It's a form of multi-party amendment. There's then other adherence letters as well as bridge provisions, whereby you tie the ISDA documentation to a specific market, such as, for example, North American electricity or power markets or European power markets. So we can come back and look at the standard documentation produced by the LMA, key provisions in the capital market area, as set out in the International Capital Markets Association handbook, including we'll refer to some of the repurchase provisions, as well as we'll look at the ISDA 2002 Master Agreement. Through all of these key sets of provisions, we can understand the structure and operation of the international financial markets, international financial system, and then how we manage all of the rights and entitlements within these markets through the use of standard documentation. This is necessary because of the difficulties and limitations that would otherwise arise in attempting to adopt a public international law system. We can do this effectively in practice through the construction of a market self-regulatory model through the preparation of standard documentation by key trade associations in each of these key market areas.